Schubschlag vom Wasser aus erzählt.
Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von unserem Podcast Schubschlag. Alles, was ihr wissen wollt übers Rudern und vor allem Geschichten, die der Rudersport schreibt und geschrieben hat. Mein Name ist weiterhin Carsten Bjeski und heute mit mir zusammen ist nicht Matthias Zappel-Zander, denn Zappel hat sich eine kleine gesundheitliche Auszeit genommen. Von daher mal an dieser Stelle hier von mir aus alles Gute. Wenn ihr wollt, schreibt dem Matthias, schreibt dem Zappel auch ein paar gut gemeinte Worte, dass es ihm schnell wieder besser geht. Wir machen heute noch was ganz anderes. Nicht nur, dass ich hier alleine heute bin als Host, wir haben einen Gast, sondern der Schubschlag geht heute auch mal ins Englische. Denn ich habe irgendwann mal vor Weihnachten in den sozialen Medien gesehen, dass es eine ehemalige britische Ruderin gibt, die in den sozialen Medien deutlich gemacht hat, dass sie auch während ihrer aktiven Zeit erst falsch diagnostiziert wurde mit einer sogenannten bipolaren Störung und dann später sich herausstellte, dass sie eine hohe Form des Autismus hat, wie das behandelt wurde, was das mit ihr gemacht hat und vor allem, was sie jetzt damit macht, nach ihrer aktiven Karriere, dass sie nämlich versucht, das heißt dann auf Neudeutsch neurodivergente Krankheiten, um dafür mehr Aufmerksamkeit zu bekommen. Das werde ich jetzt mit ihr in dem Podcast besprechen. Wir werden gleich auch auf Englisch weiterreden, denn mit mir zusammen ist hier heute Kara McMurtry. A warm Hi. Welcome from my side, Kara. So this was more or less kind of Chinese to you. The German introduction. I was just saying that. Well, it's only me today. Not the two hosts of us. And I was just giving a very brief introduction of that. A couple of weeks before Christmas it was, when I was surfing social media, I saw some of your stories, and I thought, wow, that is very remarkable, also very interesting. And I thought, hey, why not give it a try and ask Kara whether she's willing to talk about her past and also her present activities. And she said yes. So this is why Kara is with me in our virtual studio. And I would say, we do this in the German show as well. Kara, why don't you just introduce yourself in a kind of 1 minute elevator pitch? Tell the listeners of who is Kara, very briefly, I think almost 10 years, I think, or 10 years at international rowing level. You won some nice medals. You rode at the Olympics last year. So that is, this alone is already quite a performance. But then maybe also then, the main reason why we're talking today. Floor is yours, Kara.
So I started rowing through an outreach project that came to my state school. It wasn't a normal route into rowing anyway. I was the only state school kid to go to the Junior World Championships in 2009. Once I started rowing, I absolutely loved it, and it became like my obsession. But I would say that, I thrived at juniors, I thrived at under 23s, and then I got onto the senior squad and just started to struggle. I was misdiagnosed with bipolar and put on medication, quite heavy medication for that, for 5 years, and what should have been the peak of my career. And then came off in 2019 and was re-diagnosed with high functioning autism. The combination of coming off the medication and gaining an understanding of myself and how to advocate really transformed my well-being and performance. And I went from being a spare in 2019 to racing in Tokyo. And also I raced in the Lucerne World Cup in 2021 and got a silver medal in the women's four. So that was good. So it's not just me saying that I felt better, like my performances were a lot better as well. But it was just unfortunate that I feel like I lost 5 years of my life and my career. And you know, by the time that I had the understanding of myself, I was tired and kind of disillusioned with it all. So yeah, and that leads to where I am now, which is trying to make change from the outside and raise awareness.
Yeah, so that's Kara, and I think that is, you know, you already touched upon this, but let's get back to, so you started, when did you notice, or did you notice that something is wrong with you, that there is, or was it you felt tired? Because when I read your website, it also said, well, you very often after practices you feel extremely fatigued, tired, burned out. So you know, how does an athlete actually get to this stage to, I don't know, ask a doctor what's wrong with me? Yeah, and how did you get, and even though it was a completely wrong diagnosis, so how do you get to the stage and actually to ask the doctor to get into this kind of sessions and
I mean looking back, like autism is just differing neurology and behavior traits, and you can imagine that if you don't know that you have it, and you almost, when I was growing up, no one really knew that girls could have it, but yet you feel so different, and people talking, it doesn't necessarily make sense to you the way that they're thinking. It's very different to how you're thinking. If you think every interaction you have in the day, you feel alienated and different from other people and misunderstood in what you're saying, and like you have to put a lot of effort into what you're saying to be accepted, and that's really tiring.
Maybe Kara, for the audience, Kara, how would you define autism?
So that is what it is. It's differing neurology and behavior traits, and it's characterized by things like sensory differences and differences in the way that you think, and like thought patterns and things like that. So you might be quite, you might have like quite a rigid way of thinking, or black and white, or for me, I'm like uber honest, and I have to tell the truth. It's, that gets me into a lot of trouble, but I can't not do it. And you like your routine, but you also like to do things your own way. And I don't mean just like, but like it's like a compulsion.
You have to.
Yeah. It's very distressing if you don't. And you have,
but
like,
then rowing can be a good thing, because there is a lot of routine in rowing.
Well, yeah, and that's probably why I was drawn to it in the first place. Like when I started it, I was like, oh, I love this. But then it's also why it's very distressing when you go from being very much in control of your own program. And you know, when I was in control of my rowing and my pathway, I succeeded. I got to the junior worlds and I got to the under 23s, and then moving onto the squad where it's centralized and you're expected to be a certain way. When you're not, and you're not given the understanding that you're different, and you're not given the support, and they try and sort of shoehorn you into a box, of course it's going to take its toll emotionally. And then I should add that there's a lot of research at the moment to show the that there's a huge amount of crossover between autism and ADHD, so especially high-functioning autism. And for me, I definitely have a lot of ADHD characteristics as well, and for women, especially with autism ADHD, there's a lot of women have been misdiagnosed with bipolar because of the way that it presents. So with the ADHD, you have like lots of energy, lots of ideas, and then it kind of is countered by the autism, where maybe you come up against almost some impasses that you can't get over, and it's like kind of like does not compute. And
so it's the ups and downs, the highs and the lows that are more
exactly, but it's not coming from mood, and that's the point. Yeah. It's not just purely a mood disorder, like, because it's from ADHD autism, it's like it could be changed by your environment or support needs, or like, yeah, so it's different. It's like it's innate and it's behavioral, it's not mood and hormones. And therefore, I guess that leads me on to the fact that when you then get prescribed medication to change your mood, it has no impact, and if anything, it has a negative impact because it's not a mood disorder.
How did you now get to the medication? So there you are. For the Germans listening in, so the centralized program in the UK means that you're really living somewhere together with the senior A squad, and then you started. You started to realize or to feel different, or it was that you felt a kind of fatigue, that you went to the doctor, how was the first step more before you then were prescribed medication?
There were a few times when I'd sort of talked to the GB rowing doctor, and she was quite good, but like, again, even 10 years ago, nobody really knew that girls could have autism. And I felt listened to and cared for, but nobody was really hitting the nail on the head. And it was actually a GP that diagnosed me with bipolar and suggested I go on medication. But I guess the problem that I have with the centralised a rowing system and the medical support there is that was communicated, and I always put it on my drugs declaration form, and I always discussed it, and people could see the impact it was having, but no one ever questioned it or scrutinized it until 5 years down the line when a different performance director came in.
Could you have said no?
I'm sure I could have said no, but like at the time, the narrative in my own head was that I was different. I was wrong. There was something wrong with me. I needed to take this because, you know, I'd also been told by coaches and things like I'd had a lot of feedback about my behavior and my personality, and in no uncertain terms told that I had a personality problem. So, you know, this narrative in my head that was like, I'm wrong.
You're wrong. Okay.
I need to take this because that's the only way that I'm going to be able to achieve my dream. And you know, one of the things about autism is that you're very conscientious. So you're like a dog with a bone. If someone tells you that it's supposed to be an expert and that knows more than you, that this is the way to do something and this is the solution, you're kind of like, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to have to suck it up. And that's what I'm going to have to do then. And you know, if you can't do it, that's your problem and you're weak. So I was kind of like, I need to be strong. I need to just do this. I need to find a way around it.
How old were you back then? So you're now 31, so there was kind of 20, 24, 25?
So 20, 22 maybe.
Okay.
So a bit younger.
And how did your teammates react? Because obviously that is the whole thing. You are something between a teammate, a friend, and a competitor, I guess.
Yeah. To be honest, like, a lot of them didn't know. And like, as I was sort of going on to the medication, I kind of like missed out on the Rio Olympics, even though that was what I was preparing for.
Yeah.
And then when I sort of came back, it was a whole new bunch of athletes who didn't know me before.
Okay.
So, you know, the coaches should have seen, wow, there's something's changed with Cara.
Yeah.
But the athletes, I can't blame them because they just didn't know me before, so I guess they assumed that's just what I was always like. But I was like a shell of myself, really. And it just exacerbated all of my autistic traits because I think it made me so tired that I didn't have any energy to mask.
It simply made you more tired. It didn't do any good.
No. It made me more tired, and it made me more sensitive to like light and sound, and I didn't have the energy to stop myself from saying things and putting my foot in it and being brutally honest, like all these things that I need all my energy at the best of times to kind of navigate, I didn't have that. So I probably wasn't a great teammate. But yeah, I did have friends along the line, and I kind of did disclose to a couple of people, but not loads of people, because even bipolar's also obviously got a huge stigma, and I don't want people to think that.
Yeah.
I didn't want people to not trust me as a teammate. So yeah, but I just...
During all these 5 years, you were still member of Team GB, you were still member of the program, so you were actually there suffering. So getting more tired, somehow getting the feeling, well, you know, shit, this isn't working at all.
Yes.
I would assume that then probably also your physical performance probably did also not really benefit from it. So this must have been horrible.
Yeah, it was horrific. Like I look back yeah. and I'm like,
well, but 5 years, Cara.
I know, I know. And that's the problem with, no, I don't want to say that's the problem with autism, but like it kind of is the problem with being so conscientious, and just blaming yourself all the time, because you have to remember, like, everybody's got a narrative. And if you grow up thinking that you're very different and there's something wrong with you, and if you grow up and people are telling you that you're a slow learner, or that you're stupid, or that you're different, or that you're difficult, that's your bottom line. That's what you tell yourself. So whenever you're going, you know, you're going through trouble, and, you know, I had sensory issues, I put on 8 kilos, I was getting slower, I was tired all the time, I was like, this is my problem, and I deserve this.
Wow.
And so, yeah, it got to the point where I couldn't really see, like, I really was like, I don't know where this is going.
You still made the teams in all these 5 years? Were you still?
I was still on the team. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how, like, I wasn't at the top of the team. I was always sort of like struggling at the bottom.
Okay. But still, so you were in one of the boats. Therefore things were still going okayish.
So it's not, it didn't get to the crunch point where it was like,
exactly,
it didn't force me to make a decision. But in 2019, it kind of did, because I didn't make a boat, I was a spare.
Yeah.
And then a new performance director came in, and I think that, if I'm very honest with you, because you know I love to be honest, I just love it. I think that when he was introduced, I think the coach has probably said, this is what the squad looks like. We need to get rid of this athlete and this athlete and this athlete.
Yeah.
And I was one of those people. Yeah. And he said, because he was a very person-centered performance director, he said, what have we done for this athlete? And the coach has said, we've done everything we can, which involved sending me to the doctor and sending me to the priory.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't think we have. And so he was the first person in the entire 5 years to scrutinize, like, what was going on. And fortunately for me, there was a newly formed UK sport mental health panel, and I was there first.
Had he talked to you before? So, or was this just out of the blue that whatever the coach has presented their list, you know, this is.
So I think he kind of had that conversation with them, and then I had then had a conversation with him,
a one-on-one,
somewhere outside of the training center.
Yeah.
And then he was able to like advocate for me, and he sent me to this new panel. And they looked at all my medical records, they spoke to people, they spoke to me, they came to my house. And basically they were like, yeah, you don't have bipolar, you have high functioning autism most likely. You don't need to be on all this medication. Like the lady that I ended up sort of working with for a bit longer, she said, like, I can't believe that you have been on this medication and rowing, because I have patients who can't get out of bed.
Jesus.
When they're on it.
Yeah.
And like, to be honest, I could barely get out of bed, but I just did.
But listen, Kara. But this was an enormous moment for you then. So all of a sudden you hear. But this is like waking up in the middle of a horrible nightmare. So then all of a sudden you have these people telling you, well, you don't have any bipolar disorders.
I didn't have any time to
no.
I didn't have any time to sit and reflect and really? Get over it. Like I was like, okay, right, great. But I've got 1 year. No, but I've got 1 year now to make it to the Olympics.
Well, there shows the autism. so no time to reflect.
No, okay. Because I was like, right, that can happen later when I've achieved my goal.
Yeah, all right, okay.
But like, I need to find a way to make it to the Olympics now.
Yeah.
Like, I've wasted all this time and I'm bloody tired and I've probably only got a year left in me.
Yeah.
So like, they said that to the coaches, the coaches asked, well, how much of an improvement are we expecting?
Yeah.
And like, they said, yeah, there should be a significant improvement. And then the coaches like later on said to me, like, we did not expect how much you were going to improve, which just shows how much the lithium was taking its toll, because I basically got 17 seconds faster on my 2K.
Well, that's a lot.
That is a lot. Yeah. And after. And then, like I said, like I went from being the spare to, basically being like one of the top sweep athletes. And unfortunately,
I saw a picture, I think you said in the engine room, wasn't it, of the eight? So
You know what, it's a shame, because that eight was not what it should have been.
Okay.
And that was a lot of management problems, and that was because of COVID. They ring-fenced the squad. It was basically, if you were there, you were in. And for me, what was frustrating is that I think I was still blacklisted. So even though I was one of the best athletes, and in my opinion, like, I should have had a seat race for the four, because when I got in it in Lucerne, it got a silver medal, and that was the best result that it got that year.
Yeah.
But I wasn't allowed to be in that four because of everything that had happened, and because I had autism, I imagine, and I can't be trusted. So. Yeah, so it's frustrating that.
But Kara, back to, just, you know, sorry for interrupting.
That's all right.
So, because you said that's 17 seconds, and okay, you're saying, well, you know, because I got rid of the medication, but you know, because I am interested in the person. So, don't you think that there was also really relief, which pushed you? This relief that somehow you know, someone now realized.
Yeah.
And what is going on, and giving you kind of the right. Doesn't this also feel a little bit like relief, or did it feel like relief?
Yeah. So it wasn't. I don't think I let myself, like I said, feel relief, because I think relief then means that you take your foot off the gas. But what I did feel was understanding and understood. Mm-hmm. And the lady that I worked with was incredible. And she actually, we worked together to do a bit of like trauma therapy, but partly because of like childhood stuff. And then partly like being on that medication and trying to get my head around it. And we also came up with a communication plan. And so, as well as coming off the medication, like seeking that understanding of myself and knowing how to advocate and what to ask for from the coaches, that was the other bit that made a big difference. So I had three things on my communication plan. One of them was, when you ask me how I am in the morning, make sure you ask me like a closed question, don't ask me a big, broad, open question, because
a yes or no question.
Yeah, basically, don't say, how are you?
Yeah.
What does that even mean? I don't know. I'm fine.
Yeah.
Like, but there'll be loads underneath.
Do you feel better than yesterday, for example?
Yes, exactly. Yes or no. Has anything changed since we last spoke?
Yeah.
Another one was, if we've had a big group briefing, to just take me aside afterwards, like 20 seconds, and just ask what I got from that briefing. Because sometimes, because I don't follow the same thought patterns as other people, occasionally I get a different message. And obviously in a team, you just want to make sure that everyone's got the same message. And it's really simple, and, you know, it's quite easy to correct me if I say, I think I got this, and they're like, no, you got that, and I'm okay, fine. And then the last thing was to make sure that on training camps there's like plain food, which sounds really funny, but like, yeah, when I'm tired especially, I don't want to eat like really flavoursome food. Like, I'd rather have plain pasta.
Okay, yeah.
But what I would say is those things really, really helped me, but yet the coaches couldn't continuously do it. So I'd go through a period of being really successful, and then they'd be like, okay, she's fine now. And it's
then,
like...
Okay, and then they stopped again.
Drop the ball. And it's like, yeah, no, I'm just... This is just me all the time. Like, it's not... Yeah, so I really don't think it's that hard.
It was treated like a temporary sickness.
Yes, and it was treated like a mental health thing. And it's like, yeah, it's not. So it's you. Just... It's just me. Yeah, yeah, it's me. Yeah. So yeah, like, I would say it was the understanding as well as not having the medication that really helped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is interesting. Well, so this, and then, you know, back to sports. So you said, okay, I have a bit of mismanagement then with the eight last year. I didn't look it up, but you made the final. I think you didn't medal, but you made the final in the eight in Tokyo.
No, we didn't make the final. It was really bad. But like,
okay. Wow. Yeah.
It was bad, but like, I was actually really proud of how I dealt with it. It was a real testament to like what I'd gone through, because everyone else in the crew, and rightly so, because they had been treated like, I don't want to swear, they had been treated very okay, badly. <yep. laughs> They'd all had the rug pulled out from under them. And it had been the first time that it happened to them. And so they were all breaking down and you know, they were so far off their PBs and I was looking around like, I can't believe that we're racing at the Olympics and it's not their fault. It was, like I said, it was the management, but, I was there sort of in the middle of it, getting my PBs.
Yeah. Wow.
I was like completely on a different track. I was like peaking and everyone else was not. And I think it's because of what I'd gone through. And I was like, as much as this is a horrible experience, it's literally nothing compared to what I've gone through. And
exactly.
But then it's not anyone else's fault, because you can only sort of learn and react from what you've had experience of. So if it's the first time someone's dealt with adversity, like, of course they're going to find it difficult. And they shouldn't have been put in that position. But yeah, it was a weird situation for me, because I was like, oh, for once I'm like, I'm the one who's fine. I was proud of how I kept it together then.
And then weren't you tempted to continue as a high performance athlete?
Yeah. So I did actually for like 8 months, was it 8 months or 6 months or something? I swapped sides because I had an injury after Tokyo, but I think what it was is my body was just, I was just hanging on. Like, I'd been through so much and it had taken its toll. And there was that thing that was like, my body was done, but my head was like, oh my God, I've just found myself. Imagine what I could do.
Exactly. You know, yeah.
And so I
just got going. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got, you know, I was quite good on stroke side. I swapped to stroke side and I like won some of the matrices and stuff. Not like that.
Very good, yeah.
Came like second at trials just from a couple of weeks on that side after like 17 years of rowing bow side. Yeah. And again, that's just a testament to like the place that I was in. But lo and behold, my difference kind of got in the way again, and I had like, I was brewing an injury that I thought I was talking about, and I thought I had explained myself, but apparently I didn't. And you know, I was, it's, I hate to like sort of keep, it's like, I feel like it's such a sad story. I keep sort of talking about how I was mistreated here and I was mistreated there, but you know what, it is what it is. I don't care. I want to change things for the future. But yeah, again, I was like basically ignored and I was sent to the psychologist. And then I put my foot down and I was like, no, I'm stopping. you're scanning this, you're looking into it, and I had, so my hip, I had, well, we knew I had a camera pincer and a tear, and I had capsulitis that was like really quite bad. Tendonitis in my psoas, tendonitis in my glute, and then a ruptured disc in my back. And yeah, it was just frustrating because I'd had pins and needles after Tokyo, and I'd kept saying like I'm injured, but kept kind of getting patched up, or I think they thought I was stressed. As the thing about autism and that label is people think that you're hypersensitive and you're stressed, and it it's not as simple as that. Like, you can be hypersensitive to light and sound, but you can also be hyposensitive to stuff within your body. So like I would say that I have a high pain threshold, but yeah, if something's too bright or noisy, then I can't deal. But anyway, so people tar you with the same brush, so they're kind of like, you know, I must have been saying it hurts, it hurts, it hurts, and they're like so yeah, that was the final, that was the final straw. When I got sent to the psychologist, I was like, I'm out of here. I'm done. I don't have anything more to prove to you. Like, fortunately for me, everything that I'd been through the 2 years before, I was like, I've done it. I just wanted to prove it to myself.
Yeah.
And then that gave me the power to step away that I didn't have before. I was like, no, you know what? I am good enough. And I am capable. And I'm going to take this fight outside. Like, after Tokyo, like, everything had been shaken up so much. I was like, all of the work that I put in to getting understood, it just been thrown out the window. And I was like, really, what needs to change is something much larger. Like, how neurodiversity and autism and mental health is viewed in sport in general. Because if it's just me and my little bubble and me just changing people around me, like, as soon as I leave, it's gone.
Yeah.
So what's the point? And yeah, that's just led me to where I am now. I was like, I need to take this outside, and I need to help more athletes than just myself.
Cara, but that is an enormous personal transition that you made.
Yeah.
So this is kind of also moving away from the athlete, Cara, and then really, you know, kind of, you know, becoming much more mature, and then also having the guts, and finally, I think probably also the self-consciousness to make the step. So that is, I think this, you know, that's also what, you know, what interests me most is really the people behind the athletes, because we're also having discussions in current German elite rowing about, well, you know, where sometimes rowers are just labeled as material, and not as persons. And I think that is an enormous and very, very courageous step that you made. If you before we then talk to actually what your aim is now with this, with the organization you started or founded, if you now look back at these 10 years as an elite rower, with all these horrific stories, changes, what is it that your kind of personal takeaway from these years? Is it really a kind of this relief that after these 10 years you finally know who you are?
Yeah, it's a bit of that. It's a bit of, I think I probably always have struggled wherever I went.
Yeah.
Because society as a whole was not ready 10, 20 years ago to accept people who think differently. And, you know, I might have fallen into a job where I got along, but it's unlikely. So, you know, I can't be like, oh my God, like, sport ruined me. It didn't, because I love sport, and I love, there's so many times that, regardless of all the difficult times that I had, that I did really good ergos that I could be proud of. I lifted really heavy weights that I could be proud of, and I overcame challenges that I could be proud of. And you know, although I would say my relationships with other teammates has been sort of not fractious, but like sort of tarnished over the mm-hmm. over the years, because I could never fully open up and be myself. Mm-hmm. I still did have friends, and I met some really lovely people. I guess I think the thing it's not an answer to your question, but I'd like to say it anyway, because it's kind of what drew me to this podcast. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't usually speak on a sports podcast, because I find that a lot of sports podcasts are sort of, they want to know about the medals and they want to know about exactly. the successes. And mm-hmm. and for me, that doesn't do justice to a lot of people.
Correct.
And yeah, one of the biggest lessons that I learned, and I'm going to turn this into a positive, but it starts as a negative, is that some of the most successful athletes are not very nice people. So I know that sounds really bad, but I find it really hard to celebrate success, because to me, success doesn't look like medals. If you get a medal and you're a fantastic person, then I'll celebrate that, because that is amazing. But I've met a lot of people who don't get the glory in the end, but they're great teammates and they're great people. So yeah, and then I guess that leads to like, that's a revelation I had, and that's leading me to sort of discover and try and guide.
Do you think you're gonna take a couple of your former teammates with you into this next chapter?
There are some that I don't contact them all the time, but I won't fall out of touch with. Yeah. So I do keep in touch with a few of them. I keep tabs on them, and especially, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a few like that. But I think because of what I'm doing is very specialised with neurodiversity, like none of them are particularly, I don't think any of them are neurodivergent but as people, but that doesn't matter, because as
exactly
they're lovely people, and I do keep tabs on them, I think.
I think that's very, very good what he said, that, you know, it's not only about success. It sometimes it happens that very successful athletes can also be nice persons, but often they're not.
That's someone who is really nice and who I'm speaking to at the moment is Anna Watkins. So okay. She's like the CEO of the BAA, and we're thinking of ways to collaborate, because obviously they're like a union for athletes. So yeah. I feel like that's a good example of someone who's like done some really incredible things and is genuinely a nice person. Yeah. So shout out to Anna.
Yeah, that's good. Well, that's good. So listen, and now you're going to do neurodiversity. I think it's already how did you then really get to this stage that's okay, obviously, this is your thing, this is your theme, but that is one thing. But how do you then decide actually to start such a organization? Yeah. To really make this your current profession.
It wasn't really until like I've properly finished rowing. Well, yeah. When I took a step away to rehab and I kind of was thinking about stopping, mm-hmm. that I gave myself that time to actually discover myself, because even though I'd known for a couple of years before that I had high functioning autism, like I said, I just was doing what I needed to do to get to the Olympics. I didn't give myself time to understand who I was. And so when I sort of stepped away, I still had that narrative that there was a lot that I couldn't do. So I never thought that I would be capable of setting up my own business. Mm-hmm. I never thought that I would be capable of advocating for anyone other than myself. Like, I could barely advocate for myself in sport. But then it was the longer that I was away from that place that was very traumatic for me and suppressing, the more I discovered myself and the more I was able to open up, and the more I felt stronger and And I started to reach out to other people like me who I had never really had contact with before. I always felt so alone. And there was never any role models. There are no role models at the moment. And yes, they weren't in the sports sector, but regardless, it was a particular conversation I had with he's a CEO of a recruitment agency for neurodiverse people, mm-hmm. and he's 27 mm-hmm. and he has ADHD and autism. And I was like, you are incredible. And yeah. he sort of gave me a little push over the edge. He was like, right. your story's great, you can do this. And I was like, yeah. oh, but just yeah. the knowledge that I had a role model and also someone there for me to ask questions to if I yeah. needed to.
A bit of a sparing partner.
Was yeah. huge. And yeah. I never had that in sport because no one looked like me. And I think that would have been a massive help. So yeah, that's kind of what I needed. And then this is a bit of an autistic thing. Like the year before I had started a Start Your Own Business course.
All right. Yeah.
And then I finished my Start Your Own Business course in September last
yeah,
year.
Yep.
And then in September last year, I registered a CIC. And I was
cool. Because you have to continue. Well, there's autism. So
I've done the Start Your Own Business yeah, course and now I can start my own business. it's fine. Easy as that. Yeah, if you know, you can do it. But yeah, so I did that and then it's been pretty... sort of just grown quite organically since then, but it's not been too hard because I'm just really it's my new obsession. I'm so passionate mm-hmm. about it. I can mm-hmm. do it from 8 mm-hmm. in the morning till 10 at night.
And then what are you then doing now on a daily basis?
Yeah.
What is the reach out? Are you reaching out to people? Are you you're flooding social media with content? how does your daily routine look like now?
Yeah. So trying to tell my story and put bits out there about my story, but I find that so hard. Like I find it really hard to shamelessly like promote my story, but I'm trying to do it.
Yeah,
so
it. Yeah.
What I'm doing as well to sort of like kind of help me with that and counter that is tell other people's stories as well.
Yeah.
So I'm reaching out to other neurodivergent athletes from all different sports with all different neurodivergent conditions. I mean, they're
how
coming.
How do you get to them, Kara? It is not that they on their forehead have whatever.
No,
we are neurodivergent.
And so many people don't want to talk out because of the stigma, and it affects their careers.
Yeah.
So I've had a lot of contact from people who just want to talk to me but don't want to be promoted yet.
Really?
Okay. Loads of women as well who have been misdiagnosed with bipolar.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And have autism. So I shamelessly put like stuff on groups. I initiate or ingratiate myself into different groups on say like LinkedIn or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'll put a post up. I beg for forgiveness rather than permission. And then like occasionally I'll get one or two and then it spreads and it snowballs and it's word of mouth. People see it and they tell their friend or family member and if you put enough out there, people will come.
So it's really through the grapevine. It's really kind of the network, and then they get back to you. You know, just give me an idea. You know, without mentioning any names, obviously. But what is it like? Five people a day sending you an email and sharing their stories. Is it one a week?
It depends. They come in sort of like
in
floods,
ways.
Depending
yeah.
on when.
When
you
posted something,
yeah.
when you used your elbows to get into another group on
yeah,
social media.
Yeah. And often, and sometimes it's people following the group, and I'm like,
yeah.
If someone's followed, some random person's followed it, it's usually because they have a reason to, right?
Of course.
And
yeah.
so I'm like, mm-hmm. I bet I'll get a message from them in a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
Okay.
And sometimes
yeah.
it takes a couple of days, and then I get a message.
Yeah.
But yeah, like lots of different people, lots of different sports. Like, you know, I recently put a video out about Greg Searle and he just randomly contacted me. So
nice. Yep.
And I'm about to put a video out about a GB a wheelchair basketball player who has autism, and she's a great one to speak because she obviously has the physical disability,
mm-hmm.
but she herself says that is not a barrier for her. Like, her barrier is an understanding of her neurodivergence, and I'm like, yes, because people see the wheelchair and they understand it, but for her to say that is like very impactful.
Shouldn't then the next step, because one is obviously creating awareness and kind of whatever, collecting a group, getting people together. But then shouldn't the next step actually be educating? So and educating the others.
Yes.
Educating the doctors in national teams. Well, I wouldn't go. Sports associations, et cetera, et cetera.
I don't think I'm going to tackle. Yeah, I don't think I'm going to tackle the medical side yet. But like, that is another aspect of what I'm doing. So I do the promotional stuff, and then every day I'm having conversations with different charities and organizations and sports clubs and things, and with the purpose of collaborating and educating. So I've got like 1,000 things on the back burner. It's lovely for my like ADHD side of my brain. Like when I was rowing, I think I felt really suppressed because I wasn't, things weren't like interesting enough for me. So it like made me just like, oh, and then now like I feel so alive and invigorated because I've got 1,000 projects on at once.
Rowing addressed the autistic side of you while obviously the ADHD
neglecting the other side. It's difficult. It's a tough one. But yeah, sorry that I digress. So I've got like a lot of things in that department. So I've got the media, the collaborations and education, and then the third thing I'm doing is I've got a little group of people who are interested in the subject and are prepared to do research. So I'm obviously only one person, so I was like, well, I can't do this myself, but I thought, right, if I've got people who are willing to sort of volunteer their time, what is the biggest thing that's going to help me? And I was like, I can do the talking to businesses. They need to hear my story. I can do the talking to athletes because they want to talk to me. What I don't necessarily have time for, what other people could really help with, is the research, which doesn't exist. So I've got a little research group at the moment who are taking the first steps to basically fact find what's going on with NGBs at the moment. What does it look like? What data do they collect?
You approach universities or what?
Not yet. No. So it actually started from one of the people that approached me, and I told his story.
All right.
And then it ended up that he had done human geography at university, and he was interested in it. And then I get people basically just contacting me. But I haven't got around to contacting universities yet, but that is on my list of things to do. I want to contact the university research departments. And then also I want to contact, recently in the like last 5 years, there's some university courses that like specialize in not just business, but basically non-profit business. Cause it's like, it's quite a growing sector. And then I thought, well, they must have placements, like fundraising placements, where the students like have to learn how to fundraise. And then I was a bit like, I wonder if I can if I can approach the university and be like, I've got a CIC that I really need fundraising for. Can you send some of your students this way? That is on my list of things to do, but I have like stuff to do every single day at the moment.
So already any contacts out of Germany? So otherwise maybe our audience might also be interested
I'm absolutely happy to talk to anyone from any other country as long as they can speak English. but
obviously this is not a British thing. Yeah, so this is a global thing.
It's a global thing, because I've had contact from America, Australia, Denmark, and Switzerland. Oh, that's really bad that I just confused the two.
Something with an
SW. But yeah, like, so I've had contact from people all over the globe so far. So yeah, the only caveat is that I am really bad at languages. So yeah, apologies. Yeah.
Well, it is. Listen, Kara, oh, we're almost getting closer to the end of what I said.
Yes.
You know, we never try to do more than an hour. And I learned I should never ask open questions.
Because I ramble on.
No, because that was part of your communication plan at Team GB. So, but still, you know, that is, you know, what interests me is now more or less getting to the end is, you know, this stupid HR question. If in your dreams. What would you like to achieve with the CIC in 5 years from now?
Oh, I really have a thing about if you say it, it won't come true, but I'll say it anyway. Yeah. I don't know exactly how it will look, but I want to be impacting athletes on the ground, like neurodivergent athletes. I want neurodiverse sport to be a big enough name that coaches and clubs and organisations know it and they respect it, and it's changing perceptions and it's educating people. That's what I want.
Well, I think that's pretty good. It's, you know, pretty good for answering an open question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The good thing is that I've had practice of, like, the more that I talk about myself and what I'm doing, the more I kind of know the sound bites.
Yeah, yeah. But you're growing, so that is very good.
Yeah.
Listen, Kara, is there anything that you would still like to share with me?
No, I don't think so. That's a big open question. That's. No. I think it's when it's to do with my thoughts and feelings that it's really hard. If it's based in fact, it's easier. But it's like, how do you feel? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, I tried to poke you a little bit, here and there, and kind of on your feelings, because I think that this is really that is also interesting, on really these kind of, you know, maybe for your next talks, so really to think, okay, you know, really try to think back on these special moments, you know, when you had the talks, then when you get the message that hey, it is not bipolar. But it's something else. When you get the message, hey, you know, get rid of this medication, ASAP. Yeah.
You know what happens though when I get there too much. When I get too much into the thoughts and feelings, I get really upset. Yeah. That's the thing. So I had a call the other day.
Are you reliving it? Because you're reliving it.
Yes. For some reason, I was just. It took me back, and I cried.
Yeah.
But like, it's easier for me to stay distant and like just talk about it and have loads of energy when I'm talking about it. But yeah, sometimes I kind of go back there and it's not very nice.
Kara, why don't you just, you know, because you have your CIC has a website, and why don't I give you the honor, you know, to just share the name of the site with our listeners, so that they could also check it out themselves.
Yeah, so it's literally just www.neurodiversesport.com, and also we have Instagram and LinkedIn, and everything's just Neurodiverse Sport because it is the first of its kind. So I've kind of got all of the names, like there's nothing else like it, so which is a shame. But yeah, and I think I'm going to have to get Twitter, and it does have Facebook at the moment, but I think I'm going to close that down because no one really uses that. So.
All right. I think that was good. That was your 30 seconds of pure commercial. And really, people, you know, check it out. It is a fascinating story. And it is, I think, especially for sports, you know, be it at the elite level, but also be it at every level. It is Yeah, I think really it is important to understand these kind of neurodiversities better, and understand also that people who might appear to be different can be different, and that there are reasons behind it. Kara, I thank you. I really thank you a lot. It was a big pleasure from my side.
Yeah, it was really good.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing this. And I really hope that you also will get nice comments from Germany. And stay in touch.
Thanks yeah, a lot. Thank you. You're a really great host and you made me feel really comfortable. So thank you.
Thank you, Kara. Stay on the line because I have to do the German okay. the German ending, and then we're gonna talk afterwards.
Yeah.
So, ich hoffe, dass das interessant war für euch. Wieder eine ganz spannende Geschichte. Einfach mal sich die Webseite von der Kara anschauen. Beim nächsten Mal wieder der ganze Podcast auf Deutsch. Das war wieder mal eine Folge vom Schubschlag. Bis bald.